Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. I do note that a quorum is present. The first item of business that we have is approval of minutes from the January 9th, 2023. I'm seeking a motion for approval. Representative Baker, you make that motion. Are there any, thank you, Representative Baker. Are there any questions or corrections that people have for the minutes from January 9th? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from January 9th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next item on the agenda we have is we have the joint committee minutes from our meeting on January 10th that we had yesterday. Is there a motion to approve those minutes? Representative Knorr, would you like to
make moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knorr moves approval of the January 10th Human Services Finance and Human Service Policy Joint Committee meeting minutes. Any corrections? Seeing none, all in favor of the approving the joint committee minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion approved. Very good, everyone. Welcome today. It's great to see everyone. We are going to continue our education. We have got people from the Department of Human Services and from the counties that will be making a presentation today. One of the things I'd like to remind people of is it's a habit we all have to get back in the habit of when we're in presence is that any testimony or any questions, making sure that we're asking through the chair and for people to wait for me to recognize them so that we can keep things funneling through the chair. So that's just not only for ourselves, and I know I'm still getting used to it, so I understand we will make errors from time to time. So at this point, we will go ahead and get started. We have Mr. Burdick, Director of State Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. If you'd like to start with the presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick, Director of State Government Relations with the Department of Human Services. Really glad to be back before you all today and in person as we start this new session. So our goal today is to build on some of the remarks the Commissioner made at your committee hearing earlier this week and also introduce you to the leaders of DHS who oversee our various programmatic areas and get a little bit of a deeper dive into the work that DHS does and the different parts of DHS and how that work integrates, as well as to sort of meet some of these folks and get to know them a little bit as we begin our session here. To kick things off, I want to just sort of do a deeper dive into some things that the Commissioner talked about the relationship between the different layers of government that oversee and interact with the Department of Human Services. So as the Commissioner talked about, you all really have a primary role in the work of DHS. You help us to really set the framework for how we do our work. You also, of course, appropriate our budget. So we have a vested interest in having a collaborative relationship with you all as we do our work. The federal government also has a lot of intersection with the Department of Human Services. Depending on the programs, we may be interacting with half a dozen different federal agencies. And some of the big ones you'll hear a little bit about from our presenters today are Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Administration for Children and Families, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, amongst others. And they are really also a primary partner. Oftentimes, the programs that we operate have federal funds that also flow through those programs, as well as federal requirements that provide the overarching structure for how the programs operate. And then the state has some flexibility in most programs to further refine and make this really workable for Minnesota. Our tribal partners are another key partners, and I want to spend a moment quickly talking about the unique relationship we have with our tribal nations. And oftentimes we talk about our tribal partners and our county partners, and you'll be hearing more about the county role from our county friends here today later in the presentation. So if you think about it, counties are sort of an extension of the Human Services Department. They are the operational arm of DHS on many of our programs and really do the day-to-day work of enrolling people in different programs and oftentimes delivering some of those programs. And again, you'll hear more about that as our presentation goes on. Tribal governments is a bit unique. Our relationship with them really recognizes the sovereign status of our tribal nations. And so oftentimes the role that DHS plays is either as sort of facilitating that relationship with the federal government or supporting tribes in operating human services programs within their own sovereign jurisdiction. And so our role is often one of technical assistance, helping resources get to where they need to go, but less about them carrying out the work of the state. It's really about them carrying out the work for their people that they are serving. Also, we rely heavily on our provider community, nonprofits and others that are out there in the community that are actually delivering the direct services. Those are some of the key constituents and partners that make all of this working in collaboration make it possible for people to access the services that they need. And so we'll talk a little bit more about what that looks like in the various program areas. Just a little bit about who we serve. We serve many, many people around the state and from all walks of life. Children and families are a big portion of who we serve, people that may need economic assistance, access to health care, other things like that. People with disabilities, including people with mental health and substance use challenges, is another big part of the populations that we serve, helping to make sure that services are available in when people are in crisis or have ongoing support needs. And then older adults is, of course, another key population that we work with as we provide funding for nursing homes and assisted living and in-home services for older adults here in Minnesota. Just a snapshot of kind of the breadth and magnitude of the impact of the work that these programs serve. So you can see nearly 1.3 million Minnesotans enrolled in medical assistance on an average month, and just over 80,000 Minnesotans enrolled in MinnesotaCare. And of course, as you heard from the commissioner, those numbers have grown a bit during COVID as we've been maintaining people's health care eligibility, and we'll now need to be turning our attention to reprocessing eligibility for nearly 1.5 million Minnesotans as we come out of the COVID flexibilities around health care eligibility. We have around 11,500 folks served in our nursing facilities on an average month, and just over 85,000 people served on our home and community-based waivers. Just over 75,000 people accessed the Minnesota, the MFIT program on a monthly basis, and just over 11,000 accessed child care through that program. We've got just over 18,000 in our North Star Care for Children program, and around 445,000 Minnesotans accessing our SNAP food support benefits that we administer in conjunction with the federal government. I am going to now invite my co-presenters up here to kind of do a deeper dive into the different parts of the agency, but happy to stand for any initial questions.
Okay, and this is what we'll be doing as we go forward. We'll have our presenters and then we'll go to questions. Are there any questions initially for Director Burdick? I do have one quick one, and this is because I heard the figure a little bit in the Health Committee yesterday that I found very interesting, is that, and this is on the Medicaid average monthly eligible. You know, we take a look, we've got almost 1.3 million. And if I remember, and Director Burdick, please correct me, is that while they're covered by Medicaid, most of those people, about 84% of them, are actually covered, have their coverage coming through private insurance, through the insurance companies. Director Burdick, could you, just hit that a little bit? Am I getting that number right?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Actually, that's a great segue. Our first presenter is actually our Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare, Julie Marcourt, and I would love for her to take that because she can probably give a much more eloquent answer than I can.
Sounds great. I appreciate that. Thank you. So with that, seeing there's no questions for Director Burdick, we'll move on to Deputy Assistant Commissioner Julie Marcourt. If you could identify yourself for the record and your title and begin your presentation, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, for the record, my name is Julie Marcourt. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. And so I guess in answer to the question, since there's a question outstanding, I don't know that I'm more eloquent in saying yes. But yes, I believe what you mean is that about a little over 80% of the people who are in the Medicaid program, we purchase their care through managed care organizations that are in the state of Minnesota. So yes, they receive, their bills are paid by up to one of nine managed care organizations that we contract with.
Okay. Thank you for that.
So I will go ahead and start with this will be an overview of the healthcare administration, which is hard to put into a very succinct presentation, but I am going to do my best. The healthcare administration at DHS really oversees the state's public health care programs. These include medical assistance, which is Minnesota's Medicaid program. So those two terms in Minnesota are pretty interchangeable. When you hear medical assistance or you hear Medicaid, those are really the same thing. That is a program that provides benefits for children, families, and seniors with low incomes, as well as people with disabilities. Today, the medical assistance program covers individuals who earn up to 133% of the federal poverty level, which is only about $18,000 a year for a single adult. and higher incomes apply to children and people who are pregnant. Minnesota Care is the second of our public health care programs that operates under a federal provision called the Basic Health Program. We are one of only two states that operate a BHP, New York being the other. The Minnesota Care originally was started in 1992 with bipartisan support to provide health care to people who struggled to afford insurance but couldn't qualify for Medicaid. So sometimes this population has been, continues to be, and was referred to as the working poor. Today, people earning up to 200% of that federal poverty level are covered under the Minnesota Care Program. That's about $27,000 for a single adult person. Enrollees in that program pay a sliding scale of premiums. During the public health emergency, there has been some adjustments to that, but they typically max out at about $80 per month is the most that somebody would pay in that program. What's important to know is that these programs contribute significantly to the state's health care sector. We support hospitals, mental health centers, home care services, community clinics, nursing homes, physicians, psychiatrists, many other healthcare professionals throughout the state, as well as large support to the public health care infrastructure. Most importantly, both programs help to significantly reduce the number of Minnesotans who go without healthcare coverage. They provide health insurance safety net to low-income families, the elderly, people with disabilities, and very low-income individuals who are adults without children. There are eligibility reviews that occur that on a regular basis, although as Mr. Burdick mentioned, some of that has changed during the public health emergency and will be resuming. But when that occurs, there's a certain amount of churn back and forth where somebody may not respond, we may not be able to reach them, they moved, something happened, they go off the program for a while and they come back on. That's what we refer to as churn. And that disrupts their care. That disrupts providers' payments who expect them to come. They may still be coming for care, and then they can't submit their claim to us. It's important to note that last year the legislature did take a step, an important step, to ensure that pregnant people who were covered by the medical assistance program, instead of being subject to a renewal 60 days after they gave birth, they now have 12 months of continuous coverage. So people who have newborns are assured that they have this coverage to ensure that they can get the care they need, the postpartum care they need, the screenings that they need to ensure that they're able to care for that newborn. There are also opportunities in this as well. There are moves at the federal level to promote that kind of similar consistency for children. And so that's something that we would really encourage everybody to think about doing, is can we extend that kind of certainty to young children as well. Did you go to the next slide? Okay. So like all states, we stopped doing this renewal process during the public health emergency. This allowed continuous coverage during a very important time where people needed health care or didn't know if they were going to need health care or were they going to contract COVID and require health care that they may or may not have been able to afford. It also allowed us to draw down billions of dollars in federal funds to help us support the health and safety of the Medicaid population during this response. However, we have had, Congress has passed, provisions that require states to begin those renewals. And so we will be going through a process over the next 18 months to restart those renewals. And what's important about that is this is something we've never done before. We have a program that is much larger. We are covering 1.5 million Minnesotans. That's one in every four Minnesotans is going to go through this process. And that includes one in every three Minnesota children will go through this process. So you can see there's a lot of people's health care that will be redetermined in this process. So there is certainly the impact on those families, and we need to make sure that we can find them and contact them and communicate with them. And if they're still eligible, make sure that we're doing everything possible to maintain their eligibility. We also understand that this is going to be an incredible exacerbation of work on an already overloaded workforce at the counties, the tribes, and at DHS. So this will be a tremendous amount of work for everyone to undertake. This also will strain the healthcare sector of Minnesota's economy. So as we have people churning on and off, bills may not get paid. We're going to have some uncertainty as people transition to where they now belong. And they may not belong on Medicaid anymore, but they now we need to make sure they get connected with the coverage that they do qualify for. And so there will be gaps in that. And so we do need to try to help shore up that certainty or that continuity as best we can. But we have opportunities. In all of these challenges, there are going to be opportunities. We know that we can make investments in moving to a more digital environment. We need better ways to communicate with people. We need to be texting them, not simply sending them mail anymore. We need to invest in community-driven healthcare solutions. We've been engaging with community on how can we best connect with them, what services do people really need, how do they want to be served best, and that we're responding to those needs, that we have to understand that not everybody speaks English as their first language, yet we have most of our materials in English only, and yet we expect folks to simply understand this very complicated process that they may never have gone through before. So we have opportunities to invest in interpreter services, translation services, things that will make it more accessible for families to actually make it through this process. We also, so moving on from that, that's one of our biggest, and you'll hear us talk about that, I think, all year long, is this renewal of eligibility. But we do a lot of other things as well within the program. And one of them is the purchasing model. So as we just spoke about, we purchase through managed care organizations. We also purchase for the remaining population, so that about 16%, they receive their services through fee-for-service. And so that means DHS is directly paying those claims from providers. So we have to maintain systems that do both. We also have purchasing models where we have 27, you'll hear the term integrated health partnerships. Those are basically our accountable care organizations. Those are community organizations, mostly provider organizations, that contract with us to improve the quality of care they deliver to Medicaid enrollees while also helping manage the cost of that care over time. So those are statewide. They exist everywhere, and they layer over right now our managed care and our fee-for-service program. So they complement those other two purchasing models. But we have opportunities to look at other models, too. There's innovation here that can be done, and so I think conversations about how can we keep advancing purchasing models are certainly conversations we would love to be a part of. So there is opportunity both within our current models, but also looking at potentially new models as well. The other two pieces that kind of go together are the disparities and social drivers. Not a surprise to any of us because I think we've spoken about it a lot, but it's something we still have yet to solve for, which is the disparities that exist in our state. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are suffering some of the worst health disparities. And we can play a role in solving for that. Those populations are also disproportionately represented on the Medicaid program. So we understand that the things that we do in the Medicaid program can actually help drive down those disparities and improve the quality of life for those families. So we are certainly interested. And what we have learned and what we have spent time in the last several years is really working with communities to identify what are the unique challenges. It isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. It isn't a one-size-fits-all problem. So we need to work with the individual communities to develop solutions that they create, and we create with them, and then we support with them through investment to make sure that we can actually accomplish what we want to accomplish within each community so that it works for them. We certainly have had, we did focus on the U.S.-born black population in Minnesota. Our next iteration is to work with our tribal communities in looking at what are the unique solutions there. And as Mr. Burdick mentioned, we do have a unique relationship there, and we certainly have unique opportunity with tribes to look at perhaps doing things differently there. The other piece that goes along with that are the focus on the social drivers of health. Not everything is about a disease burden, an illness. We know that illness and disease burden are disproportionately borne by people who don't have access to food, housing, all of equitable jobs, paid leave, child care. All of those things factor into the health of a family and the overall health and well-being of Minnesotans. So also looking at ways that how can we use the healthcare sector or healthcare coverage to address some of those needs or promote access to services that can address some of those needs only helps reduce the overall healthcare costs into the future and improves the health of families in Minnesota in the future. So we also want to be part of conversations around ways to address and to really focus on social drivers as well. We do, for everybody's information, Minnesota, I mean, we should be proud. We have a pretty comprehensive benefit set in our Medicaid program, and that's a great thing, but there still are gaps that remain. We don't have a comprehensive dental benefit, for example, for adults in Minnesota. We used to, and it got reduced about, I don't know, maybe 14 years ago, and we haven't restored it. We took a small step to restore some coverage for periodontal services for adults recently, but there's more work to do there. Likewise, there are gaps in how much we pay providers. We are undertaking a rate study right now that was authorized by the legislature, and we look forward to sharing that information with you. These payments are necessary to support hospitals, clinics, psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists. I mean, we have payment structures that are very outdated, and they need attention. And they really, the payments today for many providers don't even cover the cost that it takes to provide the service. And so we would really like to work with you on addressing some of those gaps as well. The other piece that I think we need to highlight for you also is our aging technology. That's, again, not going to be a surprise that a large organization has aging technology, but in smart investments in technology will help us on a couple of fronts. Number one, make it easier for people to access their eligibility to services, the information they need to understand how to get become eligible. But it also helps on the back end. So once I get coverage, how do we make that coverage actually able for families to use? And that's where the back end systems also need attention. How we pay providers, how we enroll providers. We make it it's very difficult because we have so many workarounds on a 30-year-old system, which isn't surprising. But that takes resources then for DHS, for providers. Those resources could be better spent on care for people and less on the administrative work for us to simply get everything in order. But we need everything in order, so we need to modernize those systems so we can do it more efficiently. And then finally, I just want to highlight for folks the integration and collaboration that's really happening at DHS and particularly within our Medicaid program. The Healthcare Administration is really partnering with our Behavioral Health Division to really look at if we're going to talk about integrating care, where we have primary care and behavioral health existing as one continuum, where we're looking at the whole person, we're doing that inside too. So we're working together on studies of telehealth. It shouldn't be seven different ways of doing it. We should have common, consistent things that we cover, the technologies that are used shouldn't be vastly different. So we want to work together, but make sure it works across the spectrum of care. We're also working on looking at the study around children in congregate settings, where we know there are disparities and there are children staying way too long in places where maybe that level of care is no longer needed, but we can't find a place in the community for them. So those are areas where we're working together with our Children and Family Services, our Behavioral Health Division, the Healthcare Administration. We want to continue to do more of that so we can respond to families' needs holistically. And so I just want you to know that we're doing that because I think that's a real opportunity for us to do better. So thank you for that. Thank you for hearing me out. Sorry if I went long.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Marquardt. I do have several people who've got questions. I've got Representative Edelson, Noor, and Finke right now. We'll start off with Edelson, Representative Edelson, and we want to try to keep moving along because we still have a lot we've got to process through here. So Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner Marquardt. Can't get those words out. Okay, so you addressed actually something that I think is really important, the reimbursement rate for Minnesota Care as well as Medicaid ends up being a huge problem within our state because providers, whether it's a clinic or even the managed care plans, are saying, well, they'll only take so many. So I just want to highlight that for committee members that I hope that is something that we will address, and thank you for your work there. The other thing I do want to talk about, though, is remind me, because I don't know if everybody here knows how somebody enrolls in Minnesota Care as well as Medicaid. Are they doing that through MnSure?
Deputy Assistant Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, yes. So that is generally how. I mean, they can go in person and do an application with, but generally speaking, it goes through what's called METS, so if you hear the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System, that is generally how most people. However, as I say that, which is MnSure, like METS is kind of the underpinning of MnSure, as I say that, we do not have our age, blind, and disabled population on METS yet. So that means we're also supporting, and this is where the aging technology comes in and where certain smart technology investments need to be made. We're kind of holding a second, our legacy system for those populations. And so we have really almost two, even though they kind of come through the same door, they end up in two different systems, which, you know, you've got family members in both systems, and so that creates a challenge to really unify a family.
Just one more.
Representative Edelson, go ahead.
And I'll be really quick here. I just, you know, I will say that the MnSure process can be complicated. I think it's great, but I'm curious if the January 15th, you know, deadline is applying for some of these folks. Some people opt to not do it because they have financial burdens, and I know that there's a whole set of whether or not you can rejoin. This has happened numerous times within my community. So I think exploring what you're doing with the eligibility renewals, for people that qualify for these programs, I do want to hear more about, so maybe we can set a meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deputy Assistant Commissioner. Just wanted to highlight a few things that you said. Stopping the churn in Medicaid is a huge priority, and I'm hoping that the continuous coverage that you discussed is something that we'll see during this session. Likewise, I think the issue of the social determinants of health and using Medicaid to do some of that work, including transitional housing and helping people, you know, who are homeless to be moved from hospitals and other places where Medicaid can be used to pay for those services, is something that I'm more interested in. My other question is, do we have a plan for the renewal, the recertification for Medicaid? Because we want to have a plan. It's starting effective April 1 until March 2024, 12 months. And we know that we want to take care of those who are most vulnerable, especially with seniors. I know you discussed about the adults at the 133% federal poverty guideline. They're on 100%. And some of them may have accumulated some assets, and they may become ineligible for the programs. Do we really have a plan to also address some of the spend down and so many other things and giving them some time to really resolve that issue, or is there a plan to increase the federal poverty guidelines for the seniors so we can really help them address the challenges that we're facing?
Deputy Assistant Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, so there is a plan, although I'm not, your points have policy considerations that would have to also be incorporated. So yes, there is a plan, and the plan, quite frankly, is also still evolving as we're assessing both the federal guidance that's coming in, what flexibilities we may have, how long does someone have before we actually have to discontinue their coverage. But I think your policy questions about are there going to be opportunities or could there be opportunities, I think we're open to having any of those conversations about if there are policy things that the legislature would like to entertain or discuss, we're happy to discuss those.
Thank you. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll follow up. I know there are policy implications which we really want to address quickly. Thank you.
Okay, next, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, and thank you very much for your testimony today. Is this on? Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't hear me. I just wanted to ask regarding disparities in health outcomes, community health programs. Are you doing work specifically with outreach to the queer communities, specifically the trans community?
Deputy Assistant Commissioner Markward.
Mr. Chair, yes. We are looking at all communities, including LGBTQ plus communities. So especially if people are in, I think when we look at populations, we're going to be looking at our people in the course of care. That, you know, those are ones we need to pay attention to because their care is going to get disrupted. So if somebody is in the course of care, that's going to be harmful to them if we disrupted. Those are unique populations and special populations that we want to take special care to outreach to. So working within community organizations that can help get messages out, changes of address. There's a campaign right now, if you moved, if you changed addresses. So if there are community organizations that could be helpful in lifting those messages and spreading those messages to get the best information of how can we contact you best so that we don't lose you along the way, we will take anybody who's willing to work with us. We're willing to work with them too. So if we're missing organizations that would be really helpful, we would love to know.
And then are you also specifically
I'm sorry, Representative Finke. Yeah.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you also specifically gathering data around the disparities? You talked about disparities around communities of color and indigenous folks, and I'm just wondering if you have that data broken out as well, given that there's a great deal of data around the disparities for trans people in this country.
Deputy Assistant Commissioner Markward.
Mr. Chair, so I say yes, but I say that really cautiously because we don't hold a lot of good information. I mean, that's part of it. It's not required for eligibility. So even for any community experienced disparities, I think we are underrepresenting the disparities because many people don't identify in communities that they may belong to for a variety of reasons. And they aren't required to provide that information. So it is a place that I think, you know, we need to work carefully and considerately with communities to gather that information in a responsible way so that we can really identify and communicate to the broader, you know, policymakers what are those disparities, who's experiencing them, how many are there. Because I do think we don't hold good information in our systems, our Medicaid systems. It isn't a requirement. So we don't know. And so I want to be cautious in saying, yes, we do. But I do think we understate the disparities, if anything.
Mr. Finke? Okay, very good. Let's move on to the next presenter we have. We have Assistant Commissioner Merce. If you'd like to come forward and introduce yourself and start your presentation, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Natasha Merz, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Aging and Disability Services at the Department of Human Services. And very pleased to be with you today to give a very broad overview of some of the work that happens in the Aging and Disability Services Administration, and certainly stand for any questions members have at the end. So the Aging and Disability Services, in general, we design and administer publicly funded programs, so Medicaid-funded programs, as Ms. Markward alluded to, that support and serve older adults and Minnesotans with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. So our major programs within our administration, my administration, includes disability services. So if you've ever heard the acronym, if you ever heard the term waiver, or an acronym like CADI, CAC, BI, DD, Elderly Waiver, EW, or Alternative Care, those are all living within our policy area. Nursing Facility Rates and Policy lives there too, as well as our GEAR division, Grants, Equity, Access, and Research, Fiscal Analysis and Performance Management, as well as, of course, Operations and Centralized Functions. Our work really centers around four main goals, which are to support and enhance the quality of life for older people and people with disabilities in Minnesota through our long-term care services and support system, to manage an equitable long-term care service and support system that maximizes value and actively works to disrupt or break down the disparities that, again, Ms. Marquardt spoke to as we look at our data across Minnesota. We are also committed to continuous improvement for how we administer our services and how we design our programs. So we are also in ADSA committed to and open to different service models, innovative payment models, outcomes-based payment, things like that are also really important. We want to make sure that our human services system is evolving to build off learnings from past administration and past programs, and also looking towards the future as the demands of the people that use our services change and flex as time goes on. We also, it's very important to us to promote professional excellence and engagement in our work, including some of the very important cross-departmental coordination that Ms. Marquardt also mentioned, to really try to work to create a seamless human services system that populate different populations and people can use flexibly throughout their lifespan. So I want to take some time to talk a little bit about some of the opportunities that we see in ADSA, in the Aging and Disability Services Administration, and then talk about some challenges that I think you will continue to hear about throughout session and we'll want to partner with you on to find solutions and work towards better outcomes. But let's start with opportunities. So as I mentioned before, we have really the opportunity within the Medicaid space to design and develop innovative service models as sort of a function and a part of that continuous quality improvement value that I mentioned before. So how do we really think about using and leveraging Medicaid payment structures to create really positive outcomes for people? How do we think about how to design and use those programs and create different models and options that really give people that use services, whether they're an older adult or a person with disability, more choice, control, and autonomy in their life so that they really are at the center of designing the services that they want to have and they use those services as part of designing a life that they want to have in the community rather than having services, program, or diagnosis drive what kind of life a person has, which has sometimes happened in the past. The second thing I wanted to talk about in terms of opportunities is I think recently a greater focus on how people transition throughout the healthcare system. So again, Ms. Marquardt spoke to this very eloquently that, you know, we are hearing, and I know probably you all have been hearing about people that are stuck in hospitals that don't need hospital level of care, but we haven't found good ways to support them in community and make that transition. So we need innovative service models and ways to support people in the long term. But one of the things we've learned is we also need to pay particular attention and focus on how does that transition go, that discharge planning from the hospital to the receiving community site, and having really robust supports to support a successful transition. Sometimes when we don't pay attention to that, people end up readmitted to the hospital, you know, 2, 3, 4 days later, and that's a really bad outcome. So I think really having some emphasis and focus on how are we structuring and supporting providers across the continuum of care in having really solid transition plans for people that make sense to them and that people themselves are invested in and say, yes, this is a transition plan. It's going to meet my needs and support my family when I discharge from the hospital back to my home, wherever that home may be in Minnesota. And I would highlight a couple different programs or initiatives that focus on transitions, including the Moving Home Minnesota program, which is a federal demonstration project, and also a return to community initiative through our senior linkage line, which is part of the aging division's efforts. And certainly happy offline to have any conversations about some of those programs if that's of interest. And then finally, in terms of opportunity, we really have and are in a unique place, especially this session, to really focus on breaking down the disparities that exist for our BIPOC populations, our LGBTQIA, and our queer communities. To really, we have access to and are trying to work on our data systems to be able to pull data apart by the type of population, by race, by ethnicity, and then doing analyses on and assessing for disparities to determine our current practices contributing to these disparities. What would a new policy initiative look like in terms of would it be a net positive force in breaking down those disparities or would it be continuing some existing practices that we're trying to unwind? And a lot of that work happens in our fiscal analysis and performance management area, just to kind of tie that back to the core areas of the Aging and Disability Services Administration. Finally, in the opportunity side, really have opportunities to engage with all kinds of different communities and at a very robust level, and really, again, from an equity perspective, focusing on communities that we typically haven't reached out to and heard as much as we need to understand how to redesign policy or change program administration to meet the needs and reduce those barriers. And certainly with the onset or the availability of remote engagement, we have more opportunities than we've ever had in terms of modality. Not that that's the only way or the only best way to engage with people, but just I really see how much our engagement has changed in terms of resources, and we're able to reach more people. And now our job is to really reach them and then listen deeply to what those communities needs and think about how our policies need to flex, change, and evolve, and you know what policies and regulations might need to change. So I want to shift over to some of the challenges that we're facing in these spaces. New demographics mean new realities for our long-term care services and support system. And is no surprise to you all as members that Minnesota's oldest residents, those that are 85 and older, the number of those folks are expected to double in the next 35 years, from around 120,000 today to more than 270,000 over the next decade. And, you know, as we look at these demographic shifts, and we also see obviously the direct relationship between the workforce shortage that is really inhibiting providers' ability to provide services to people because they simply can't hire enough people or retain them with the way the current marketplace for wages is going. So the direct care, the direct support professional, so sometimes we use the word DSP to stand for direct support professional, someone that's providing hands-on care, one-to-one care for a person in a facility or in their home and community. So the direct support professional workforce is not keeping pace with the demand that we're seeing, in part because of demographic shifts, but also because of changing dynamics in the workforce marketplace. Currently in Minnesota, there's an estimated 59,000, just under 60,000 direct support positions that are unfilled in Minnesota. And so we need to find ways to work together to address the workforce shortage with a variety of strategies so that people, seniors and people with disabilities, can continue to have the lives they want in the community and get services and supports that allow them to fully contribute and bring that huge benefit to society that happens when we figure out how to include people and allow them to contribute to their communities. Finally, you know, in the workforce challenge space, I think, you know, Minnesota has should be proud, and we are proud, a very robust set of long-term care services and supports that we offer Minnesotans. We also, because of that, have a very complicated system. Lots of different programs, difficulty navigating between programs. And so one of the things that we're very committed to in ATSA is figuring out how we can subtract rules and regulations or things that are putting up barriers to either people coming into the workforce or for people that use services to be able to access those services. We always have to balance that with the need to have health and safety regulations to make sure that people are safe in their communities and getting the quality of care that they deserve. So that balance is always dynamic and changing, but we do see that there are opportunities to simplify complexity. And I would point back again to the need for some investment in our aging technology systems, which create a lot of workarounds, and Ms. Marquardt spoke to this as well, workarounds on the back end for counties and lead agencies, which do impact the speed at which people can access services or might impact the speed at which a provider can hire a new DSP and meet all the requirements in state and federal law for doing that. So that balance point, I think, has some direct relationship to the workforce in that it's always been needed, but it is more urgently needed now than ever because of we really need to tear down as many barriers as we can to get new people into the workforce and to allow people to access services as quickly as possible. The final thing I'll note in terms of challenges is I really wanted to highlight the connection between people receiving long-term care services and supports and the need for affordable and accessible housing. You know, in my administration, we are very focused on service delivery, service design across the waivers and state plan personal care benefits. But what we know is when we think about the whole person, that people need safe and healthy places to live that they can access if they have disabilities or need other types of modifications. And the lack of affordable housing, lack of accessible affordable housing, is a significant issue for people to be able to get services that they want in their communities and live in their communities in non-congregate settings. So I would just highlight that. My colleagues from the Community Supports Administration will certainly talk more about that. So that is what I have for you today, and happy to stand for questions or hang out for questions at the end, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I do have two people with questions. I will take those quickly. I do know that this is running a little longer than we thought, so we're going to want to make sure that as future presenters come up, we keep moving along. But we'll go to Representative Knorr. If you'd like to go ahead, if you got one question, you keep them to one question now and follow up afterwards. It'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make it brief. You know, Assistant Commissioner, you talked about the workforce shortage. We also understand the department is also dealing with workforce shortage. Can you briefly tell us where we are with the 245D licensing and how we will be able to resolve the backlog on that one?
Assistant Commissioner Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr. So the Office of Inspector General is that's their area, so I don't want to speak too much for my colleague, Ms. Moti. But I do know that significant investment in the Office of Inspector General workforce is greatly needed to process and manage the dramatic increase in 245D applications. And certainly we see the connection or the pain points in the policy area as you're raising, because we work often with providers also on, you know, policies, stakeholder work, and that is something that we hear all the time, is that that backlog is a significant issue in terms of accessing that. So I think investing in those areas allows the department to hire people that can actually do the applications, provide technical assistance. You know, one of the things we are also committed to is how do we make it easier for new providers to come into the system, understanding that the Medicaid space with the overlay of federal regulations with state regulations can be very complicated and intimidating for a new provider that's coming in without experience. We want to find a way to provide that technical assistance and encourage people and help them find ways to grow business models, but it takes people to do that, and people that really understand the program, services, and requirements to provide appropriate technical assistance to those providers. So I thank you for that question, and that may not be a fully complete answer, but I think I appreciate highlighting that and the connection between having good regulation and good policy. They do really go together, even as we're trying to sort out and work on finding that balance with regulation versus flexibility.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. And thank you, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Marquardt. My question is, you'd mentioned direct support professionals, or DSPs, and the workforce barriers there that we see. And you know, in tandem with that, the roadblocks to service, ultimately, for the people receiving these services. Does the department have any recommendations for improvement? And if so, do you have maybe a brief list that you could share with us?
Assistant Commissioner Burks.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. So I've got two things to share now, and I think what I would like to do is consult with my colleagues before we give you a list, because I think my list might look different from theirs, and we would want to get together and really prioritize that so it's digestible. But I think it does come down to two main things, which is investment in FTEs and people to be able to actually do the work and do the interface with people that use services, whether they're for OIG or for provider enrollment in the healthcare area, and then also those technology systems. So our technology systems are aging, and it is creating, again, you know, every time we try to change an eligibility rule or we're trying to create something new to implement a policy, doing a lot of work on aging systems, and then something we might do might break another part of the system. And so a lot of inefficiency is created just trying to manage those aging legacy systems. So I think, you know, investment in those new technologies that will allow us to be more agile on the back end and then have consumer-facing portals that allow people to access their benefits more easily, understand what's going on with their services and supports regardless of program, are really the two key pillars to addressing some of the things that you've raised. And we'll certainly connect together and get back a list of recommendations kind of on what we think some of the top investments or the top actions that would improve access.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Next on the agenda to present to us is Legislative Director Grom. Would you like to come down and introduce yourself, please, and start the presentation?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Christy Grum, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Behavioral Health, Housing, and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Administration at the department. And I also cover the Disability Services area as part of my portfolio as well. So I have the honor of working under two Assistant Commissioners, Assistant Commissioner Mers, as well as Assistant Commissioner Eric Rumdahl, who wishes he could be here today, but is at the office helping to host our Substance Use Disorder Summit. So that started yesterday. It will be wrapping up today, and I'm told there's some really collaborative energy coming out of that summit, so hopefully you'll be hearing about more of that as session progresses. And I would be remiss not to mention my colleague, Mechi Mua, who is our legislative liaison for the same policy areas that I cover. Mechi's in the back row, and she can wave. And she really takes lead on helping with a lot of our constituent issues, our legislative report. So if you haven't interacted with her yet, you might be doing that this session. So as the administration's name suggests, Behavioral Health, Housing, and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services has three primary policy areas. We call this administration BHDH for short, so if you hear that shorthand, that's what we're referring to. It used to be referred to as community supports, which Ms. Mers mentioned. So the first area in our administration is behavioral health. And this is the area that covers our substance use disorder services as well as our mental health services. So we are really focusing on a range of services across these continuums, starting with early intervention, crisis services, moving to more active, acute, inpatient and outpatient psychiatric and substance use disorder services, and then really rounding out that continuum with our sort of aftercare and supportive services to support people in their recovery journeys and make sure that they have the services to maintain sobriety or maintain mental health. A significant portion of our services in the Behavioral Health Division are funded through the and authorized through our medical assistance program. And I won't go into a lot of the weeds on those. Ms. Marquardt spoke a little bit about that program. But one thing to note is that many of our services are authorized under our state plan with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare services. But we do have a set of services under substance use disorder that are authorized under a demonstration waiver known as the 1115 waiver. And some of you may have heard of that. I anticipate you'll be hearing a lot more about that throughout session. So I just wanted to mention that that's an innovative waiver where we're testing new ways to deliver high quality SUD treatment services. Also in the Behavioral Health Division, we administer a lot of grants. You probably have heard about this. Won't go in the weeds on those either given our time constraints, but some of the really kind of top priority grants that you might be hearing about and you have heard about over the years include things like SchoolLink Behavioral Health Services, our mobile crisis grants. We have a lot of grants that go that are dedicated for the opioid epidemic towards individuals and organizations that are supporting addressing that epidemic. Moving to our Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. So this is a small division, but they do some really important work. A few things to note about this division. They've got a statewide regional network of services that are provided to people and providers in each region of the state. They also administer a mental health program, providing mental health services for people who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, and in American Sign Language. They've got a telephone equipment distribution program, also known as TED, to help people who have difficulty using the telephone. And then lastly, this area does also have grants. So they administer grants that support mentorship programs across the state, help to make sure that there's interpreter services in rural Minnesota, as well as captioning for TV and news programs across the state. And then lastly, moving into our housing services area of our administration. So this area has three kind of main components of programs. So the first of which is our rental support program. Then we have a variety of housing support services programs to help people find and maintain housing. And then lastly, we also administer some cash assistance programs for single adults. So maybe in the interest of time, I won't go too in the weeds on those, but I'll just mention housing support is our rental assistance program that I mentioned. So this is a program that provides room and board funding for people who need that. It's a pretty large program, over 20,000 people. And remember, or maybe just for your education, Medicaid doesn't traditionally pay for room and board. So this is a really important program that serves people across all of our programs at DHS. We have a couple of supportive housing services. I'll mention quickly, housing stabilization services is a relatively new medical assistance benefit we have in Minnesota. So Representative Noor, you mentioned social determinants of health and housing and how we can leverage MA. So that's something we can continue to talk about this session, as well as a few other services that I'll don't have time to go into today, but we can talk some more about those. And then moving to our opportunities and challenges, I think of these as sort of, when there's a challenge, I often think of it as an opportunity at the same time. So I'll talk about those in the same breath. So first of all, integrating and strengthening our mental health and SUD continuums of care. So over the past, over a decade probably, there's really been a movement many of you are probably aware of to integrate mental health, substance use, and physical health services. So historically, all of those fields have been really siloed in terms of how they're reimbursed, how they're regulated, and how they're structured. And so today we know that most people struggling with a substance use disorder also have a mental health condition. And so that's sometimes what we refer to as co-occurring disorders. We also know that people who are struggling with behavioral health conditions also have disparate physical health issues. And so we need to make sure that we are, as a system, looking at integrated models of service delivery. Our certified community behavioral health centers are one of those prime and priority models that we are advancing through our work in the behavioral health space. And then moving on to another really significant challenge that we grapple with and will continue to throughout the course of the session with all of you. We have some of the worst health disparities in the nation. In Minnesota, we've talked about this in other HHS committees this week. One poignant example that I want to share with the committee here is that when it comes to opioid use overdoses in the state, black people are three times as likely to die of an opioid overdose as white people. And when it comes to our native populations, they are actually 10 times more likely to die of an overdose than a white person. So these are extreme disparities that we really need to target funding to make sure we're addressing and prioritizing, closing the gap on those disparities. A few things in this space, I think, that we will want to look at and talk about this session are making sure that we're attracting and retaining black, indigenous, and people of color service providers in the housing space, in the behavioral health space, really everywhere, so that people have service providers who look like them, who can relate, and that will encourage them to stay engaged in those services. And then moving on to another significant challenge, addressing homelessness and deep poverty. So homelessness continues to be a pervasive issue. Many of you, I'm sure, are hearing about this in your districts, and it also has a disparate impact on our BIPOC communities as well. So really, we need to look at addressing some of the gaps and challenges in our housing programs when we're thinking about homelessness. So one of the issues that we need to look at is our housing support program, which is that rental assistance program I mentioned earlier. Right now, people that are on the housing support program have to pay oftentimes way over 30% of their income for their housing. And that's just not affordable, and that's not the standard in any other program. So we really need to work on looking on how to address that and make sure that people have money that they can save so that they can maintain their housing and be able to lift themselves out of poverty and out of those precarious housing situations. Deep poverty is another priority for the department. You may have heard us talking about this over the past year or two, but we had a report back in 2020. We partnered with the University of Minnesota where we really looked at people living in deep poverty. So this is someone whose income is half of the federal poverty level or less. People experiencing deep poverty, the experience that they had in terms of health disparities, and they're quite significant. So we have a lot of work to do in this area. The legislature, we're really grateful for the investment around MFIP in the 2021 session. And when it comes to general assistance and some other issues related to deep poverty, those issues have gone unaddressed since the late 80s as well, similar to MFIP. So we'll want to talk about making some changes there. And then maybe I'll end with kind of process improvements and simplification. You've got the PowerPoint, so you can see we have workforce shortages in our area as well, just like the other segments of the economic sectors. But when it comes to process improvements, simplification, reduction, we have a large volume of state appropriated and federal grants. I think everyone here knows about that. And through the administration of that large volume of grants, we have encountered some challenges in terms of internal controls. controls and compliance issues, and those have been highlighted in previous sessions, so I won't go into them, but we are working to really address those issues. And in tandem in doing that, sometimes that means that there are more there's more scrutiny that we have to place on those grants, and so it takes longer for the money to get out of the door and into the hands of community. So we need to kind of find a balance there, and that's something that we're working on, really working with other areas of the department to centralize our contracting and procurement process and to remove whatever steps we possibly can. And maybe I will end there, given my time, and happy to stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Legislative Director Graham. I'm going to keep on moving along. We've got four more presenters and less than 30 minutes to try to cover this in. And our last presenter is going to be from the counties. And the counties do a lot. Well, most of this stuff is funded through GHS. A lot of the work gets done at the county level. We want to make sure we've got enough time for the counties to be able to present and get some questions saved for them also. So with that, we'll move on to Marshall Smith. And you're in charge of direct care, from my understanding. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start your presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Smith. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer for Direct Care and Treatment. Direct Care and Treatment is a highly specialized behavioral health care system. It's the only behavioral health care system of its kind, size, and scope in Minnesota, so it occupies a unique place in the state's mental health care continuum. We treat patients that other providers cannot or will not serve, generally because of challenging behaviors, volatility, and severe aggression. Some healthcare providers do not have capacity or facilities to treat these patients. Others do not have the clinical expertise or support staff. Admissions are by referral only. Most referrals come from our county social services, courts, community hospitals, and mental health care providers. We service about 12,000 people annually, and nearly all of these clients have been civilly committed. About 5,000 employees provide services across 200 sites across the state. We're broken into five core services. The first core service is the Mental Health Substance Abuse Treatment Services, or MSATs. This is really the acute care division of the DCT services. It's made up of our community behavioral health hospitals, which provide short-term inpatient psychiatric care. Our CABS facility, or the Children and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital, located in Willmar, provides inpatient psychiatric care for youth and those who need stabilization, comprehensive assessment, and intensive treatment of specialized mental health problems. We have our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which is the largest state psychiatric hospital. Anoka treats adults who have complex mental illness. Our CARE programs, or the Community Addiction Recovery Enterprises, provide inpatient substance abuse for treatment statewide. The Minnesota Specialty Health System, or MSHS, provides time-limited mental health programs to people in residential settings who no longer need to be in a hospital, but can be provided follow-up care in a residential setting. There are three of those in the state. Our second core service is community-based services. There are five key components of community-based services. Our residential services, which provides residential group homes that operate 1 to 4 beds. These services include daily living skills, medical monitoring, and helping clients integrate more fully into the community. We have our vocational services, which helps clients with disabilities prepare and find work. These services include evaluation training and support employee-employer relationships. We currently have 15 vocational sites. There's community support services, which is made up of 9 mobile teams across the state that provide individualized clinical services to people living with complex behavioral health challenges. Our MITH programs, or Minnesota Intensive Treatment Homes, they provide foster care and wraparound services for children and adolescents with severe emotional disturbances. And then our Minnesota LifeBridge, which provides person-centered planning, positive supports, crisis stabilization, and transition services to those with developmental disabilities that impose a risk to public safety. Our third core service is forensic services, which is made up of our forensic mental health program. By statute, it's known as the Minnesota Security Hospital. It provides secure and non-secured inpatient treatment for individuals with chronic persistent mental illness. Most of the patients in our forensic mental health program have been civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous. We have our forensic nursing home, which is like any other nursing home, except this one is state operated. And it provides secured, licensed nursing home settings for individuals who come with people who are MIND, mentally ill and dangerous, or people who are sexually psychopathic personalities or sexually dangerous persons, or people who come from the prisons that are on a medical release from Department of Corrections. We have our community integrated services, which is a team of 8 clinicians working with patients who have been provisionally discharged, their county case managers, and others to ensure that the patient's continued psychiatric stability and successful reintegration into the community. And then our forensic examiners, which are really examiners that are provide court-ordered competency and pre-sentencing mental health evaluations. These can be done in inpatient forensic services or other community settings, including jails. Our fourth core service is the outpatient services, which is made up of the special care dental clinics. This provides routine dental and restoration work to people with disabilities. We also have our outpatient psychiatric and telehealth services, which is offered through our clinic in Faribault. And then lastly, our fifth core services is the Minnesota Sex Offender Programs. And there are 4 components to that, 2 secure treatment facilities, 1 in Moose Lake and 1 in St. Peter, our community preparation services, and our reintegration services. When we look at direct care and treatment, I'm just going to cover highly the opportunities and challenges. But as a health system, we try to use best approaches in providing effective mental health treatment, the appropriate level of care, and community placement. BCT currently is using the Malcolm Baldrige Performance Excellence Journey. We are in the second stage of implementing a rigorous quality performance improvement process known as the Baldrige Performance Excellence Program. It's sponsored by the U.S. Department of Commerce. The ultimate goal, of course, is to earn the coveted Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award, which is given to a select group of nominees each year, and is the highest level of national recognition of performance for any U.S. organization. DCT has been honored with the Initial Commitment Award for its progress that has been made in leadership, strategic planning, customer-related processes, measurement and knowledge, workforce, and operations. Another opportunity within DCT is our quality of care, and this is over 2 years we've developed a program known as CORE 4, which is an innovative model that intertwines 4 best practices of care: person-centeredness, motivational interviewing, trauma-informed care, and positive supports. CORE 4 gives staff a deeper insight into how trauma and others can affect patient behavior and provides a better understanding of how patient supports and clients are during their treatment and recovery. A second challenge is staffing and workforce, as everybody else has mentioned, but like every health system across Minnesota and nationwide, DCT is facing a critical workforce shortage, and it's no exaggeration to call this situation a crisis. The foundation of every healthcare system is people. Without the right kind of people, the right number of people, or the ability impedes our ability to care for patients. If we look at recruitment and retention, it's never been easy in a highly competitive labor healthcare market, but the problem has been greatly magnified with the pandemic and with a low unemployment rate. And currently, DCT has 700 vacant positions. As you can imagine, the shortage puts great strain on our remaining staff, who put staggering hours of volunteer and forced overtime over the last 2.5 years and are suffering from every kind of burnout you can think of. Overtime hours are running 20 to 30% of the total worked hours, depending on the facility, well above the industry standard of 2.5%. This has strained our operational budget to the breaking point. The implications are tremendous. The lack of people can erode quality and lead to unsafe conditions for the patients, clients, and staff. Please know that we cannot admit patients to our facilities unless we can safely care for them and care for those that are already within our care. Our limited treatment capacity, even though we are treating more and more patients, demand for beds in psychiatric hospitals always exceeds supply. Waiting lists for admissions are lengthy. DHS has been subject to recent lawsuits filed by civilly committed individuals who've been on waiting in jails for DHS-operated psychiatric hospital placement under the 48-hour priority admission law. This problem is we can't admit new patients until the current patients are discharged and a medical appropriate bed becomes available.
Excuse me, Mr. Smith, I'm going to cut you off there, cut your presentation short. I do have one question here, and then we want to move on to the other one. So I want to say thank you for your presentation. I know there's a lot more. We just have very limited time. Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say briefly, when it comes to discussions about the 48-hour rule, Mr. Smith, I'd be interested in having further conversations with you. When it comes to the points you're making about demands for admissions and then the challenges about being able to place people out in the community, the forensic program lives at the intersection of the criminal justice world and then the civil commitment world. Often I'm hearing from jails that they want to be able to release the individuals they are holding into your custody to be able to receive the services that you're providing. But I also know that there are individuals that are in the forensics program that are assaulting staff, that are incredibly violent, that are destroying the units that they are living on. And staff in that facility is saying this person would be better served in the jail system because you are not equipped to be able to handle that level of aggression. I'm just curious if there's any thought or work being done to try to help that process to be able to make sure that the people that are on each side of that line are getting the services that they provide. And if someone is in the custody of DHS that is regularly responsible for assaulting staff, sending staff to the hospital, just property destruction to $10,000 worth, if there's anything that DHS is advocating on to be, make sure that person is in the correct setting.
Mr. Smith.
Yeah, Chair and Representative Frederick, it'd be very difficult for me to answer that in a short period of time, but I would appreciate having some time to meet with you and talk over those issues and what we previously talked about of what we can do legislatively as well as institutionally.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, Vice Chair. Next we have, Representative Hankin, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, one more question for you. So sorry to bring it back up.
That's okay.
I believe it was last August that we heard in the news that a man who had been found guilty of possession of child pornography and was sexually dangerous had escaped from a mall in St. Peter during a group outing. Is there anything that DHS and you guys are doing to ensure that that doesn't happen again?
Mr. Smith.
Yes, Chair, and I'm sorry, Representative.
Hankin.
Oh, Inga?
Yep,
Inga. You know, we always put protective mechanisms in place when people are in our community restoration program, and those people are under complete surveillance. Part of it is to develop the skill for them to adapt back into the community. At any time, any patient could run from the scenario, but it's always our goal to keep them in a protective watch within an arm's reach, but at times, you know, it does happen. But we do look at that very closely through our root cause analysis and say, what could we have done to prevent that differently, and then implement that throughout our organization. It's part of our quality improvement.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll move on to Inspector General Moti.
Thank you. My name is Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS. I know we have limited time, so I will keep my remarks at a very high level, and so I can leave opportunity and time for our county partners on this. The DHS Office of Inspector General, as we refer to it as OIG, delivers background studies, licensing, and program integrity services to promote the health, safety, and well-being of Minnesota children and vulnerable adults. Background studies are conducted for health and human service workers to determine if they've committed a criminal or maltreatment act or conduct that would disqualify them from either providing direct care or being within situations where they have access to children and or vulnerable adults. Just at a high level, we do background studies for 67 different provider types across DHS, MDH, and a few other state agencies and organizations. And of those 67 provider types, each of them have varying different criteria, so it is a very large system that we do administer. Our licensing division monitors and investigates compliance with state laws, rules, and investigates maltreatment and licensing violations. And then we have our Financial Fraud and Investigations Division, which does audits and investigates providers and recipients for potential fraud, waste, and abuse in public programs administered by DHS. And that is for us to, this division's oversight is for us to provide accountability and ensure that the taxpayer dollars are spent appropriately and efficiently on this. just want to highlight some of our opportunities that we're looking at going forward. Regarding our background studies area, back in, I believe it was 2021, the legislature had created a background studies eligibility task force and charged that task force to really look at our chapter, which is a 245C, which is very complex and complicated on that. And that task force concluded in December of 22 with a final report submitted to the legislature with some recommendations. And so we look forward here at the DHS to work with the legislature to see if there are any changes or revisions or updates to be made within that structure, 245C. And then we have also, I'm going to highlight a few of our program integrity efforts that we have done in the last several years. So OIG is in the process of refocusing our program integrity services to a more of a preventative in detecting and predicting of financial fraud, waste, and abuse, starting with shifting to being more proactive and data-driven and having equitable approaches. We have started this within our child care assistance program and our provider investigations team there. One of our key results with that has been our early and often team, which with the input from the legislature we had created, it is comprised of both our child care licensors from our licensing side, as well as our child care provider investigators. And this team works closely with those applying for child care center licenses and newly licensed providers, offering technical assistance and feedback within their first year of operations to in order to increase compliance and to reduce financial fraud, waste, and abuse. So essentially to help them be prepared so that the funds that are going out the door from us are going out correctly so that we don't have to look at other sanctions or recoupment process. This has been very well received, and we are many providers are asking us to expand it to more established programs on this, and so we hope to expand this approach to our other services to ensure that the we're accountable for Minnesota taxpayers. We have a few other opportunities that we are looking at in our licensing area. We've begun a child care systems transformation initiative to improve and to integrate the information technology systems used for our licensing, our certification, and our child care assistance program registration for child care providers in Minnesota. Essentially, this is creating and implementing a provider hub so that a provider can go into one spot, provide the information that we either need for both licensure, for certification, for CCAP registration in one spot. This is creating a provider user experience that we can also interface on this. This was funding that we received in the 2021 legislature, and we are on pace to begin implementation next month for our first set, which would be certified child care. We are using this as a basis and to learn from this as to how we do and implement new systems. And so we want to expand this integrated system to our other DHS licensed provider types, and we'll be looking and working with you to be able to do this. We're also having our regulation and modernization projects for both our licensed family child care, which most people think of are those child cares where within an individual's home, and our child care centers. These rules and regulations have not been updated in many, many years. And so we have a full-scale modernization project with an outside entity that specializes in child development and child regulation to come in, working with stakeholders, licensed providers, parents, and families to update this to our current era. So there's extensive stakeholder engagement on this. So these are a few of the opportunities that we are working on right now. We will say that some of our biggest challenge is always going to be our staffing and infrastructures on that. A lot of our staffing has not kept pace with the licensed number of licenses that we are issuing. So those are some of our biggest challenges. And with that, I will pause for questions.
Okay, thank you so much, Ms. Moti. Inspector General Moti, thank you for the presentation. I don't see any questions at this point. I know that we're skipping over Assistant Commissioner T. Brown for the moment. We're going to jump over to the county presentation at this time, seeing that they are an integral part of how the services are executed here in the state. So at this point in time, I'd like to welcome forward our county partners. From my understand, we've got Matt Freeman and Stacy Hennen. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourselves, please, and start your presentations. We've got about 10 minutes. I'd like a couple of minutes for our questions that are probably going to come up also. Go ahead, whoever would like to start to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA. I'm also a Human Service Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, which represents all 87 counties and their commissioners. MACSA represents the Human Service Directors all across the state. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present here today. Our goal was to provide kind of a contrast or a supporting perspective of how counties and state work together. So we designed our presentation to integrate with the presentations here, so we'll skip the sections that they skipped as well. And we'd love to come back to the committee and talk further on some of our other work, including a megatrends project that our members have been working on, talking about what are the large systemic policy things that we see coming down the line over a number of years. So thank you for your time and allowing us to be here. If it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my member, Stacy Hennen, to introduce herself and start presenting.
Sounds great. Stacy Hennen, if you'd like to introduce yourself, start your testimony, please. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Thank you for having us. My name is Stacy Hennen. I'm the Human Services Director for Western Prairie Human Services, which is a joint powers entity that involves Grant and Pope counties. I'm also the Human Services Director for Traverse County Human Services, and I am MACSA's legislative champion. So that's kind of my role here. I think that, you know, one of the reasons that we're here today is because we are one of only about a dozen state-supervised, county-operated human services entities, and so the partnership that exists between the Department of Human Services and counties, Minnesota counties, is extremely important. Almost all of the programs that they talked about today are programs that we do the implementation for, we do the eligibility for, we do those kinds of things for. So we wanted to talk about kind of what we do and how we do it. I think the other piece that's important is that in varying degrees, you know, a lot of the programs that we operate also have county levy dollars involved in them and are funded partially or primarily through the counties. So I think that's another piece of that partnership. You know, I heard several times people from the department talk about the systems, the antiquated systems that we operate. We would agree that the systems that we operate within are pretty antiquated, and we would certainly support efforts to modernize those systems and move the process forward a little bit. So you heard a little bit about DHS about public health care programs, so medical assistance. Counties administer medical assistance. We verify eligibility. We work with residents to navigate state-provided systems. We work to coordinate and integrate care. That includes doing the non-emergency medical transportation, certain zones of that, either within the county or through a contracted entity. We're also charged with providing the local perspective for public health care programs during the managed care procurement process. That's a very labor-intensive process that of developing, evaluating, and scoring requests for proposals from managed care organizations that are interested in us. 33 counties through Minnesota also do something called county-based purchasing. So we utilize a joint powers agreement to purchase health care services for those who are eligible for public programs in our counties. So county-based purchasing is a unique health plan operated by a county or group of counties with particular goals for improving access, improving coordination, and supporting community providers. And we'd certainly be happy to talk with you in the future about any of those kinds of things.
And we're happy to take questions anytime folks have as well.
So I think that, you know, one of the things that we also, that the department talked about is the significant challenge as we unwind the federal emergency, the federal peacetime emergency. It's about 1.5 million Minnesotans over the next 18 months that will have to have their eligibility redetermined. I think that the things that the department's concerned about, we're concerned about as well, the churn that occurs. We're also concerned about just the simple workload and tasks for county staff to be able to implement that and the timing and the ability to do it. So I think that that's something that we want to make sure people are aware of, that with the workforce shortage and technology challenges, we think that that's going to be a pretty tall task, and we're working pretty hard to make sure that we meet that so Minnesotans get their needs met. I think that the thing about medical assistance eligibility to remember is that it's often the beginning of the eligibility for other programs like waivers, certain kinds of case management and certain kinds of programs. So we understand the importance of eligibility being done promptly and being done appropriately so that people don't lose coverage and so that people maintain the services that they need. So I think when we get to the aging and disability service, along with assessing eligibility and conducting case management and helping manage personal budgets or oversee waiver budgets, for waiver programs, we also do things like vulnerable adult services. So we do case management, we do intake, case management, screening assessments for vulnerable adults. We also do Minnesota Choices, which is a comprehensive web-based application that integrates assessment and support planning for Minnesotans who need long-term services and supports. It's used by certified assessors to utilize a person-centered approach to making decisions about long-term care. One of the things that we do is balance that person-centered approach with the capacity and availability of services available by using the MinChoices tool to kind of determine where people's service needs are at. We're set to go live with an update and a revision in April, and we're really hoping that that occurs. So we need some long-promised efficiencies with that system, recognizing that the initial rollout is not going to be without some problems. All right, so we're kind of moving through these quickly. Hopefully, if you have questions, you feel free to ask them. So I think the amount of information on the health, on the behavioral health and housing slide is indicative of kind of the significance of the urgency that we see in this issue, in this area right now. So transition to direct access for substance use disorder changed the role and relationship for counties around substance use disorder. Individuals can now go directly to a provider they choose, get a comprehensive assessment, access care immediately. And that has eliminated the role of Rule 25 assessors in counties, but it has also provided, again, some direct access. I think that there are benefits to that system and there are challenges. We have seen the challenges, particularly in areas that have minimal resources. Counties still work to identify and ensure adequate resources in their community, and we determine financial eligibility for publicly funded chemical dependency treatment. Last session, we came forward asking for additional funding for AMHIs, or Adult Mental Health Initiatives. That's a key resource in developing community services. AMHIs are regional collaborations charged with overseeing adult mental health services and funding to counties and tribal governments. They were developed in response to closures of the regional treatment centers, actually, in the 1990s. We feel that they're underfunded to meet the goal, but that they've been an effective mechanism for regional collaboration. So we would certainly want to advocate for increased funding and increased collaboration in that. Workforce and continuum of care issues are substantial as counties across the state struggle to serve their communities with an inadequate mental health care system. I think the system of care for mental health, SUD and disabilities communities with an increasing number of justice-involved incarcerated individuals are experiencing untreated mental health conditions and substance use disorders due to a lack of resources in communities. Integrated solutions with law enforcement are new services that counties have been working on providing across the state.
Maybe we'll pause and see if anybody has questions, Mr. Chair. I know we're going pretty quickly through a lot of stuff that's pretty dense.
No, I know it's pretty dense. What I'd say is just keep on hitting through and let's take any questions at the end so that we can try to hear the presentation as much as possible. So we've got about 4 minutes here and then we've got a little time for questions.
Okay, so direct care and treatment. Part of the county role is to help individuals move out of state-run facilities through case management and case coordination, identifying and facilitating transitions for complex and high-needs individuals is very challenging. The shortage for appropriate beds across the state remain a problem. I think that that goes to the lack of workforce as well that we've talked a lot about. People get stuck in beds that are inappropriate to their needs but unable to move because there aren't other beds available. In addition, counties pay some of the costs for individuals in state-operated facilities who no longer meet medical criteria. I think that to address the shortages in the continuum of care, many counties are forced to turn to investing levy dollars in building out local placement service options where a provider can be found that is willing and able to serve these individuals and develop a new placement. I think that we, yeah, our states continue to lack community services and placements for those with complex needs.
And then we're going to skip the child and safety and permanency to align with DHS and their presentation as well. So we'll close with the Office of Inspector General. And mostly our work in background studies and licensed facilities, we're really reliant on the state to carry out those services. As we work through the peacetime emergency, there were significant challenges in conducting background studies and a backlog as those developed that we ran into both for other folks that are providing services at counties and in a lot of our facilities. And we appreciate the investments from the state to try to address some of those backlogs and the importance of an effective and well-funded OIG for program integrity. So I think that closes up our areas, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And we've got three people on the list here. I've got Representatives Baker, Edelson, and Nori. You'll get one question each. I know they'll be around a little bit afterwards here. So Representative Baker, if you'd like to start us off.
Please. Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that abbreviated version. I know we're in a hurry. I asked the Commissioner the question the other day about just how are they handling working from home and the customer service levels that the counties are either getting or lack of. Ms. Hennen, you're in the field out there doing this just like my county administrators are back in Candiota County. And I've heard concerns that as this partnership is critical to make sure that the state is working with the counties. And can you give me your feedback, honest feedback, about how is it going the last couple years maybe with, again, just the challenges of we're working remotely and sharing what you can share, because we need to hear kind of the what is happening out there to give our counties that kind of support. Thank you.
Stacey Hennen.
Thank you. I think that this has been a really challenging time, and we've been faced with a lot of different circumstances that we've tried to navigate. And working from home has been a valuable tool in allowing us to keep really serving people as people struggled with their own circumstances and illnesses and things like that. So I think that we would be remiss to dismiss working from home as an option or as a possibility. I think one of the things that we talk a lot about in our agency and that I know other directors talk a lot about is that balance, is really finding that balance of what are front-facing services, what are services where we interact directly with the public and we need people in office to do that, and what are services that we can maybe do more kind of a hybrid and more remotely. So I think it's something that as we work going to the future with a pretty significant workforce shortage, that we would be remiss not to utilize the tool. But I would agree that we need to be careful and remember, I think one of the things we talk a lot about is that our primary job is to serve people, is to serve the people who live in our local communities. So we need to be as present as is necessary for that. Technology has actually given us a great deal of tools that we've utilized, but I think that there's a reality that there are some things that just have to be done face-to-face and in-person, and we're kind of navigating that along with addressing the workforce shortage.
Thank you. Representative Edelson, very quick.
I'll be very quick, Mr. Chair. I want to say, Mr. Chair, thank you for this meeting. This was very helpful. And wow, we're in trouble. Because I think that's what we should be all getting as we're leaving this room today. Because I heard a lot of staffing requests, and we don't have people to hire. So we need to get creative. And I think that's really going to be something we need to look at. And I'm not just talking about the counties. It was DHS. And so I heard a lot about technology. And I think technology in terms of efficiency can be really helpful as we move forward. I guess what I'd be curious with, and we don't have to answer the question now, but I really would like our members to know on this committee, when's the last time we did a full-scale update on our computer technology system so that they're interacting? Because I'm really concerned about this. I'm really concerned about this, and I actually mean this in a very serious way, because it's happening at MDE, where I just came from, Education Finance. It is happening all around, and if we're going to be dealing with this in a smart way, we need to really invest in our technology. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would
Go ahead.
Thank you for the comments and the concern. I think it's shared by counties across the state. AMC rarely focuses on some of the intricacies of things like technology. It's one of the top priorities that came from county commissioners, the need for our technology systems to meet our needs, to be efficient, to support our challenges in workforce, and also along with additional money, how we go about doing that modernization, getting that feedback from folks on the ground who are working and engaging with folks receiving services is really important, and counties stand ready to have a strong voice on what is going to work and what our needs are there.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. And very quick, go ahead, Ms.
I just want to give an example. So I agree. I would thank you for highlighting the challenge, and it is a challenge. We are hiring people now who have never seen or heard of our systems. We know some of our systems are, I would say they're DOS-based or they're green screen systems. We are hiring people who come to work for us who have never seen them, have no idea how to operate them, and are quite surprised that that's what we're doing. So I think it is a crisis point for the training time and the complexity involved in them makes it really difficult for us.
Thank you for that additional. And then Representative Knorr, and we are a couple minutes over, so go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hannon, Mr. Freeman, for the presentation. I don't think we're ready to discuss Max's PRISM, SSIS, and MIS, and whatnot. We know the challenges. 40-year-old system is not the best system, so we better do something this year. The question that I have for you is I want to hear more about case management at the county level and also more about the investment of the opioid settlement dollars. I know we skipped that, maybe in a different setting. We will come back to that. Thank you.
Yes, those are important things we want to come back to. Thank you for referencing that. I know that the opioid settlement is also very important for Representative Baker also. As we're wrapping up here, I want to thank the counties and the department for being here today. I know there's a lot we didn't get to. Some of these things may come back in the future as we have bills that are related to this subject, so we'll try to make sure we have these folks available at the appropriate time. Nick, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to note that tomorrow's meeting of Human Services Finance, Representative Neuer's committee, will be doing a deep dive into the DHS budget. While it's not strictly in our jurisdiction, all of our members are more than welcome to join. That's the same room at 1 p.m. tomorrow.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Neuer, for the invitation. We appreciate it. And then finally, next Wednesday is when we'll be meeting next. And at that point, we will have our first bill. We'll be having the conversion therapy bill, and I think that is House File 16. So we'll be having that at our next meeting. So I want to thank everybody for being here today. Thank you for the questions, and have a good afternoon.